The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
So, to steal a joke from Duncan Hallis, by the same logic, Lenin led to Stalin and Jesus led to the Crusades. That's all true. What we really want to know is there something about the Bolshevik Party, their politics, and their practices that actually made Stalinism a logical outcome? And I guess to take a step back, I want to ask why this question matters. Oh, thank you. Why this question matters, because when I talk with my friends who aren't socialists, they think that I'm vaguely obsessed with the Russian Revolution. They don't understand why this is such a big deal, like what is it about Russia? And I think that this revolution is one that is really pivotal for people who are trying to figure out, can we fundamentally change society, and if so, how? So this is really, literally a pivot around that question in world history. People look to this revolution to answer that question. And so what was 1917? I'll quote Chris Harman. He says, "The revolution of 1917 gave control of a major country to a workers' government for the first time in history. To millions throughout the world locked in a savage and futile war," this is World War I, "it offered new hope. In the period afterwards, people everywhere turned from the grim alternatives of declining capitalism, unemployment, poverty, fascism, threat of new wars, to place their hopes for the future in the regime of the Soviets, or the councils of ordinary working men and women that had put into power in Russia." And so the reason that people are interested, so very interested, in this particular question is because that revolution speaks to both the promise and power of working class revolt, and the lessons from it dictate what it is that we can and can't do today. They help us think about our possibilities. So there's real concrete content to answering this question. Right-wingers say, yes, Lenin did make Stalin. Leninism made Stalinism. And they use this as a reason why people should never hope for a better world. Yeah, it will always make a strong man if you try to change things, always, because people really can't rule themselves. That's the underlying content. And deep in there is they really don't think you should have fundamental change. That's why they're saying this. They're saying Lenin led to Stalin because they want to discourage fundamental change. Liberal commentators think that Stalin was just too revolutionary. So you can change the world, but you have to play by the rules. And these are folks who fundamentally think that you can't have fundamental change. You can change things, just not fundamentally. And some anarchist critiques say that Lenin did lead to Stalin because all organizations are authoritarian. And these are folks who sincerely hope for fundamental change, but honestly don't trust other people to help them make it. A subset of anarchists and other leftist critiques are more interesting. How is it that we're strong enough to win a revolution while still maintaining democratic organizations? Do certain types of organizations lead towards bureaucracy? And best, in my opinion, how actually did Stalinism happen? Like, what concretely occurred to make that happen? And today I'll argue that what happened in the 1920s in Russia was actually a counter-revolution. There was not continuity, but in fact, sharp discontinuity between Leninism and Stalinism. And I think that seems a little odd to us because we feel like we can recognize counter-revolutions, right? So like we look at Egypt, we say, that is a counter-revolution. But I want to use a compare and contrast with 79 in Chile. So is anybody willing to give me like a two sentence, what was 79 in Chile? Two sentences.
The United States government overthrew the democratically elected government of Chile, which was elected a Marxist president.
Bam. So, why is it that we can see the violent overthrow of Salvador Allende by the US-backed dictator Pinochet as a counter-revolution. We see it so clearly. Like, this is, yes. We never say that Allende led to Pinochet, right? Mm. Never. No, that's inconceivable. It's almost funny, right? There are striking similarities between these two. Western powers reacted to widespread workers' control because it was seen as a huge ideological threat. And they don't want to those workers to get the wrong idea, most especially workers here. So all workers' organizations, all political democracy was smashed by the new regime. All the leading revolutionaries were literally murdered. And a government with whom the West could safely collaborate was installed. And if you're like, wait a minute, Stalin, collaborate with West? Think World War II. That was a solid collaboration on their part, right? So we don't see these similarities for two reasons, I think, in addition to just all the right-wing crap about revolution is bad, like Hobbes and stuff. We don't see them as leftists because this was an unusual counter-revolution. So it didn't just place the old regime back in power. It put something completely new in place after the defeat of the workers' revolt. It's a new form of political economy. And it was super slow. It took 10 years for this counter-revolution to really completely smash the promise of 1917. Those two things, I think, make it hard for us to recognize this as a counter-revolution. And so I'll help with that, hopefully, today. But before we go into that, I want to just go through some definitions, and then we'll take a little break to kind of collaborate. I'll get into that in a sec. So Leninism, Stalinism. Leninism first. The foundations of Leninism are the central tenets of Marxism. It's thoroughly embedded in Marxism. And our discussion today will be preliminary at best. I would strongly recommend people go to Paul D'Amato's talk, that is next, that is What is Leninism? Because I will do maybe 15% of the job that he will. So, foundation, central tenets of Marxism. This is self-emancipation of the working class, must destroy capitalism, and create a society free of exploitation and oppression. It's like the one sentence Marxism. Lenin elaborated on Marxism, specifically emphasizing organizational forms that flowed from those principles. So people before Lenin really hadn't taken that very seriously, what organizations come from these ideas, and he did. And that's really awesome. What were his major innovations? So he said that the political party that was kind of should represent the leading elements of the working class, so the folks who are most class conscious, the best fighters, the best anti-racists, but it should represent only those components of the working class. Why only the most class conscious militants? Because if your organization holds too many messed up ideas, you spend all of your time fighting amongst yourself about whether or not all lives matter is an acceptable slogan. Mm-hmm. No, you are ineffective if you don't have some kind of homogeneity. And party members should engage in what was called democratic centralism. So this is freedom of debate, but unity in action. This is also why members need to strive to be experienced in all sorts of different struggles, to be familiar with all major political debates and current events. It's because democratic debate is impossible if we don't all try to be able to contribute to that. If we're deferring to a single authority, then that undermines our ability to have a democratic debate. So another part of democratic centralism, and this is usually considered the centralism part, is that once a decision is made, you do it. I also think that this is the democracy part, because if my vote doesn't mean anything, then it's hand exercise and not democracy. But this is considered the centralism part. And it's kind of like a union, how if you vote against a strike in your union, you don't scab. Right. Just don't do that. Instead, you follow the will of the democratic majority, and then afterwards you go back and say, wow, that was a dumbass idea. So that's democratic centralism, one of his major innovations. He also said that the party needed to be made up of people deeply embedded in every workplace and participate in the struggles and debates of their fellow workers in order to win people to left-wing ideas. Last, but so not least, the party has to be international in focus. So supporting the struggles for self-determination of oppressed people everywhere. This principle was carried out by the early Soviet government, and it actually got them into a lot of trouble. And yet it's a matter of principle. It is not just some kind of icing on the cake of Marxism. So, Lenin was the practical and theoretical leader of the Bolshevik Party, one of them, from the turn of the century up to the October Revolution. And what he actually did, not just what he wrote, but what he actually did, his lived contribution, was trying to win workers' power on an international scale. That's what Leninism is. It's trying to win workers' power on an international scale. What's Stalinism? So I've only read a little bit of Stalin's written work, mostly biographies or quotes about historical events or debates. In preparing for this talk, I just did it. I just looked up on Marxist Internet Archive and read all the Stalin I could get my little hands on. And over and over and over again, there is nothing but repeating Lenin's formulations about a centralized party. Just like about as much content as a glass of water. Just clear through. What is Stalinism then? Well, it didn't become an ism until well after the revolution. It's a theoretical construct to justify a set of class interests, the bureaucracy itself in the USSR. And I'll go through why I think that is. The first serious attempt by Stalin to write something was a book in 1924 called The Foundations of Leninism. He very intentionally built up a cult of personality around Lenin. He like embalmed him and put him in a glass case like Cinderella in the middle, so everyone could come and worship Lenin. And this particular book was part of that process. It praised Lenin's, quote, style of work. Stalin said that Lenin had Russian revolutionary sweep and, quote, American efficiency. And get this, here's how he defines American efficiency. Note the literary style, too. American efficiency is that indomitable force which neither knows nor recognizes obstacles, which with its business-like perseverance brushes aside all obstacles. Mm-hmm. Not recognizing it, but brushing it aside. And that is American efficiency, which Lenin embodied. So this is a taste of what Stalin, what Stalin's all about. The first edition of this book said that world revolution was needed, was absolutely necessary. Quote, can the final victory of socialism in one country be attained without the joint efforts of the proletariat's workers, of several advanced countries? No, this is impossible, end quote. The second edition of this same book, without any other changes, says, having consolidated power and taking the lead of the peasantry, the proletariat of the victorious country can and must build socialism. First edition, second edition, Marxism is gone, right? No other comment about this in between these editions of the same book. In another piece on Leninism, in 1926, Stalin repeatedly quotes himself. He says, this is so funny. He quotes himself in like two or three paragraphs and then says at the bottom, is this correct? I think so. And then goes on to do the same thing over and over and over again. In this book, he says, the dictatorship of the proletariat, which is sometimes used as synonymous with socialism, the dictatorship of the proletariat consists of the guiding directives of the party, plus the carrying out of these directives by mass organizations, plus the fulfillment by the population. So that is socialism in his definition in this book. So what is Stalinism? It is flexible. Even on core Marxist ideas like the international nature of capitalism and therefore the revolution. It is self-justifying. If following what the party says is the dictatorship of the proletariat, then socialism has been achieved in the USSR. And there's no need for any fancy strengthening of workers' power or spreading the revolution elsewhere. We have arrived at socialism because we do what the party tells us to. The difference between the first and second editions and the basis for rejecting that the international tasks of the revolution was actually because there was an opposition group inside the Bolsheviks fighting against the bureaucratization of the party. And so the second edition reflects, oh, gosh, shh, never mind. We've arrived. Just go home. Everything's good. Please ignore the man behind the curtain. Yeah. Another thing, and I think we need to be real, like, upfront about this, Stalinism represents something deeply brutal and totalitarian. And we're talking about massive forced industrialization. They did in an industrial revolution in 5 to 10 years what the UK did in 50 to 100. They hothoused an industrial revolution, and that comes on the backs and with the blood of the Russian working class. They also collectivized the peasants. They collectivized the peasants means that if you own a farm, you don't own a farm. I have your farm because I'm the Russian state. It belongs to me. Now you work on my farm. That was a contentious kind of thing. And so a lot of people disagreed with this, and they were shot or exiled for their troubles of disagreeing. He also had the gulags for political opposition, and about 1 million died in those. Several million were killed in the Great Purges of the 1930s. So these are huge massacres that were carried out actually along ethnic lines, because ethnic minorities like Poles or Ukrainian people were often hotbeds of political opposition to Stalinism. And so they were the target of these kind of massive attacks. And I don't know if you can say this is the word. There are so many bad crimes. One of the ones that is most tragic to me is that he turned the communist parties of the whole world into arms for foreign policy for the USSR. And the price of that was the defeat of incredibly inspiring workers' revolts all over the world. The one that should just make us shiver is Spain in 36. Like, that's on Stalin. That defeat is on Stalin. And yeah. So, what did Stalin actually do? We said what Lenin actually did. What did Stalin actually do? He jockeyed for influence within the Bolshevik Party, and once consolidated it, he brutally wielded it to maintain a compliant bureaucracy. Yeah. So that's my 2 cents about Lenin versus Stalin. Huh, like a good Marxist, I'm going to start with the context of the Russian Revolution, because honestly, you can't have a serious discussion about ending capitalism in the United States without talking about what is capitalism in the United States, right? You do the same thing for Russia. So what was the context? You're talking about a country that was majority peasant. What that means is that the large landowners in the country had big, big plots and then let peasants either rent temporarily and trade with goods or work their own plot elsewhere and work the landowners. But the people who were in charge of the day-to-day life of the majority of Russian folks were the rich landowners. So this is primarily a feudal system. But it's super contradictory because, and some people call it combined and uneven development, because there was advanced and concentrated industrial capitalism with a seasoned working class side by side with these folks who were making the same beet crop that their great-great-great-great-great-granddad did with the same tools on the same land. Like, this is real continuity in the countryside. And then in the cities, and this is a quote from an ISR article by Amit Shaki, in the cities you see a working class, though small in size, that was highly concentrated in the most modern enterprises. In 1914, 54% of workers in Russia were employed in factories with over 500 employees. Real concentrated industry. Whereas in the US, that figure was 32.5%. So compare and contrast. The Putilov Metalworks, which employed 30,000 workers in a single factory in 1917, was the largest factory in the world. And that's like the home of the Russian Revolution, is in the smelting, molten iron of that factory. In Petrograd, 60% of the workforce were metal workers. 60%. And so you have this super contradictory kind of combined and uneven development with respect to what's happening on the ground in Russia for ordinary people's experiences. Politically, you have czarism that's crumbling. It's completely crumbling. So it's increasingly out of touch. It's erratic responses to political problems. The czar happily sent thousands, tens of thousands of peasants to go die in World War I while he played around with some mystic and like red tea leaves. So this is the political and economic situation. And this is why all Russian socialists agreed that Russia could not hold a workers' revolution for long. It lacked the economic development. But they looked to the West, like good internationalists. And they thought, anyway, Western European nations will definitely have their revolution first. I mean, they have huge parties, they have massive mobilizations, and they have seasoned layers of militants in all key branches of industry. But for reasons we can discuss, Russia happened to have theirs first. Like, everybody was surprised, right? What? Russia? What? Greece? And anti-war socialist and journalist John Reed went over there real quick, and he wrote a book entitled 10 Days That Shook the World, which folks, if they want to just celebrate what human liberation sounds like and feels like, they should read this book. So he wrote an article for an American newspaper, and the subhead was First Proletarian Republic Greets American Workers. He says, this is the revolution, the class struggle with the proletariat, soldiers, and peasants lined up against the bourgeoisie. Last February was only the preliminary revolution. The extraordinary and immense power of the Bolshevik lies in the fact that the Kerensky government, and this is the capitalist government at the time, absolutely ignored the desires of the masses as expressed in the Bolshevik program of peace, land, and workers' democracy. And that is what the revolution was. A new worker state that ended the slaughter of World War I, that supported the redistribution of the landowners' lands to the peasants, and that protected and consolidated workers' control of their own workplaces. That's what the revolution did. But as this new worker state withdrew from World War I, as quickly as possible, Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, we can also talk about if we want to, the forces of Western capitalism were gearing up to side with the White Army, to rain down destruction on this new worker state. And so 14 different capitalist countries gave both weapons and troops. There's like an interesting story of a revolt in Seattle in the US where they say, no, we won't ship these weapons to go kill our comrades in the Russian Revolution. Go Seattle. We participated in that too. Everybody tried to crush this new worker state because you don't want people getting the wrong idea, a la Allende and Pinochet. The whites were made up of the dispossessed capitalists, but even more strongly represented the old land-owning class. So many of these folks were monarchists, and they wanted to bring back some form of czarism. And what this concretely meant, here's what the White Army is. When they came through towns, they would engage in pogroms. You guys know what those are? It's like a mass lynching against Jews and other ethnic minorities. So again, an ISR quote, Jason Yanowitz, estimates of the numbers killed ran as high as one Jew out of every 13 in towns that encountered the White Army. Hundreds of thousands were left homeless. Tens of thousands more became the victims of serious injuries or disease. No longer spontaneous outpourings of racial and religious hatred, pogroms now became the coldly calculated weapons of war. The new worker state had a decision to make. Are we willing to defend the revolution that we just carried out? Are we going to say, oh, never mind, somebody disagreed. Oops. And allow the pogroms to become the basis for the counter-revolution? Or are we going to defend our new workers' state? If so, they had to fight the civil war. But every Bolshevik, including Stalin at the time, knew that the possibility of socialism did not hinge on winning the civil war. It lay with the success or failure of socialist revolutions abroad. Because Russia was mostly a peasant and not a very productive, in terms of like food output, country, they had to have goods to trade with the peasants, goods, things. And Russian workers had nothing to trade. So the uneasy alliance between these two classes that had shared an interest in overthrowing Tsarism and the provisional government now began to fall apart, right? Their interests became conflicting. So this had a, if you're gonna try to save this revolution, you have to have a two-pronged strategy. Number one, you have to help the revolution spread abroad. And they did this through supporting the Communist International. The Communist International was a group of revolutionaries from all over the world. There's an article in this new ISR discussing some of the proceedings of the Fourth Congress of the International that had an incredible history. Russia spent a mountain of time and energy trying to make sure that they bolstered the chances for international revolution. They also, the other part of the strategy is winning the civil war. And so they instituted what was called war communism. The Soviet plan beforehand was that workers' control would be in the workplaces, but there would only be selective nationalization. So the state wouldn't take over all of these capitalist enterprises. But because of capitalist sabotage, capitalists were burning down their own factories so that the goods that their factory made couldn't help the Red Army, right? So because of that, everything got nationalized. If you add that to the foreign blockade, you have no raw materials, you have no food. Workers' productivity, this feels vaguely like upsetting to even say. Workers' productivity, that's like, have you eaten enough to push your lever? Plummeted, and people ran off to the country just to eat, like the countryside. So in 1920, production levels were almost 80% of what they were in 1913. That's just profound. And from this flows the grain requisitioning, right? So we have nothing to trade with the peasants, and yet we have starving workers. And the peasants no longer feel the sense of solidarity towards the revolution that would make them share. And so that is the moment where you say, are we defending this revolution? Are we going to let the pogroms run rampant over Russia or not? And that is where grain requisitioning came from. No, you're going to share. You're going to share even though you don't know that it's in your interests. The People's Commissar of Food explained there are only two possibilities. Either we perish from hunger or we weaken the peasant economy to some extent but manage to survive. This also is food rationing war communism. 75% of Petrograd workers got their bread from the black market, if they had bread. At this time, the party was incredibly egalitarian. In fact, most people had it pretty much the same, party, non-party, whoever you are, pretty much the same being absolutely terrible, but incredibly egalitarian, right? And so Trotsky, another Russian revolutionary, says this, quote, communism was rightly called war communism, not only because it replaced the economic methods by military ones, but also because it served military purposes above all others. It was not a question of assuring a systematic development of economic life under the prevailing conditions, but of securing the indispensable food supply for the army at the fronts and preventing the working class from dying out altogether. War communism was the regime of a beleaguered fortress. And this war communism included political restrictions, as were mentioned in some of the discussions. The two biggest ones, other political parties and trade unions. I want to touch on those. So many of those who called themselves socialists before the revolution actually joined the whites in order to fight what they considered an undemocratic revolution. They wanted democracy, which meant the capitalist government. And so, again, you ask yourself, should parties that run around organizing, shooting people, and sabotaging, should we allow them to organize with complete freedom? And the answer that they put forward was, why would we be fighting with the Red Army, dying on the front with the Red Army, and then allowing people to sabotage from within? And we also need to remember that these left-wing parties changed over the course of the revolution. So those who really wanted to defend workers' power actually quit their old party and joined the Bolsheviks, because the Bolsheviks were the ones who were doing that seriously. And so they left the least committed revolutionaries in these old shells of a party. And many of these socialist parties engaged in assassinations. So specifically, they assassinated a foreign dignitary that was there to talk about ending the blockade. And so, yeah, there were political restrictions put on these other socialist parties that were undermining the ability of a worker state to exist. Also on the trade unions, there were restrictions put on those. And here's a way to think about it. If your government is your employer, but your government is asking for sacrifice because they're trying to prevent the overthrow of a workers' state, isn't that a little bit of a contradiction? If you go on strike to get more for yourself, that means that your fellow workers out on the front lines get less. So is that in working class interests to get a smaller, like a little bit more of the chunk of pie for you as part of the working class, when it comes at the expense of the entire project of working class liberation? Trade unions, as autonomous, as completely autonomous, don't make sense in this particular context. So, the super fast version of wrapping up. They won. They won the Civil War. And nothing but, I mean, it's nigh impossible that they won. That makes no sense, right? But they ended up having a working class that was reduced in number by 57%. So you have less than half of the number of working people after you win the Civil War. And the victory came at the cost of the entire economic health of the country, as well as the relationship between the peasants and the working class. In response to that, the new workers' government said, wow, we need to try to hold on. And that doesn't mean more communism right now. That means something called the new economic policy. What that did is reintroduce markets into the countryside in order to make people a little more collaborative about feeding the towns that were still starving. This political accommodation led to the rise of a group of people called the kulaks. They were richer peasants, and they kind of lorded it over both the poor peasants and also the new worker state. So they would make deals about, oh, you can get grain, but only if you let me have like this larger section over here. Oh, yeah, yeah. So you have the reintroduction of the market and a rise of a class that is looking out for themselves, opposing the Bolshevik Party, opposing the workers' state. And these all added up to finding the Bolshevik Party finding themselves in a place that had a bureaucracy that had been bolstered by these interactions, by this negotiation with the peasants, with the kulaks. And they began to get a sense of their own interests, this bureaucracy. They were slightly better paid, they had slightly better conditions, and they began to see that this is actually, we don't want to go back. We don't want to go back to war communism. And I'll just end on Lenin's last testament. He said, he was on his deathbed in 22-23, he said, the party was making grave errors that showed that they put the national interests of the country above the international interests of the working class. He said the party needed to widely expand the leadership bodies, including new workers who were not part of the bureaucracy. Quote, Comrade Stalin, having become Secretary General, has unlimited authority concentrated in his hands, and I'm not sure whether he'll always be capable of using that authority with sufficient caution. Later he goes a little stronger. I suggest that the comrades think of a way of removing Stalin from that post and appointing another man in his stead who is in all respects different from Comrade Stalin, being more tolerant, loyal, polite, considerate, less capricious. This was intended for a Congress in 1923, but was suppressed by Stalin and only read aloud to a select few a year and a half later, where everyone voted unanimously to continue to suppress it. So, yeah, in just like last paragraph, Leninism, the idea that we need a revolutionary party to unite the leading elements of the working class to end capitalism, it led to the victory of the revolution. The material circumstances and the lack of healthy parties in the rest of Europe led to Stalinism. And those who would want you to think otherwise would gain only one advantage. It would take longer for us to build the ability to overthrow capitalism here in the US if we adopt the idea that Leninism made Stalinism. And so, yeah, would you give them that pleasure?
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.